Okay. A few things before we really dive in tonight. One, I encouraged you about this at the beginning. I'm going to encourage you more now in the strongest terms, since we're meeting from 6 to 7:30 now. Bring a chair. Bring a pillow for your chair. Bring something more comfortable than these things to sit in. Bring food. Bring something to drink. Bring a bottle of wine. I don't care. This is a rough time at night. I get that. And most of us are not young. I know it's harder to just sit in a metal chair for an hour and a half. So bring something more comfortable to sit in than this foolishness, unless you're trying to offer it up for the souls in purgatory. All right, aside from that, bring something more comfortable. That's going to be even more strongly recommended this summer when we start doing Shakespeare nights, if we do them in here. But secondly, I also want to remind you that last time we voted, and so we're doing from 6 to 7:30, really forever from now on, just to catch up, and especially in case I would happen to miss one more, which I hope we don't. And even with that, as I was looking through it, just the way things fall, we'll still need to go 1 week extra, but it'll be okay. I mean, it's just 1 week. I also want to say, before we dive in, that I know a number of you missed last week because you hate the Lord. But I want to be clear that really tonight is very much of a building off of last week. It's one of the few times that things are very closely connected. Because last week we started talking about Deuteronomy and the Deuteronomistic history, which is going to be the large majority of what we talk about tonight. So let's just recap that real quick, because I know that even those of you who were here might not remember all the details. So, the book of Deuteronomy is the fifth book of Torah. It is a retelling of the law as Moses supposedly stood on the banks of, on Mount Nebo, on the plains of Moab. And the thing about Deuteronomy is that it really becomes constitutive for the rest of the Old Testament. In particular, Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. And Deuteronomy, it seems, was lost and was discovered about the year 610 in the reign of Josiah. And then Josiah freaked out because Deuteronomy tells about all these blessings and curses. And then it seems that Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings were all written by either the same author or the same school in an attempt to read all of Israel's history from the desert to the Babylonian exile under the lens of the book of Deuteronomy and what Deuteronomy says about providence and how God interacts in history. Just so you know that. So the reality is that Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings all really tell one story from one point of view and deliberately suppress some things and highlight other things in order to show that point of view. And that's okay. We all do that. Right? That's what I mentioned last week. We all, when you're covering millennia of history, you have to hit the points that matter to you. You may not even be doing it consciously. Right? And that's okay. So tonight, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and 1 and 2 Chronicles, which are not part of the Deuteronomistic history, are their own kind of strange thing. And we'll only have a little bit of time for them at the end, but you'll understand why we're only giving a little bit of time to them when we get there. Okay. What I have on the board, then, is the five divisions that I'm going to talk about tonight in the Deuteronomistic history with the scripture passages that correspond to them, but I'm doing them by people, except for the last two are empires, because that way it will help you to remember them better. It's easier to remember stories about people than it is to remember this date or that date. But next to it, I also have the dates, presumably the dates, based on the best we can do. Samuel's date is the one that's the most disputed, though from the way some people talk about it, he would have been like 140 by the time he died. So I don't think that can be accurate. So we're putting him fairly commonly that he was about 70 when he died, which would make sense based off what we see there. So about 1070 BC, and then we run all the way up to 587 BC. And as you can see, some of those divisions cover a lot more time than others. And that's because the authors really pause, or the author really pauses on certain periods of history and emphasizes it. This is 483 years of history. To give you a sense of how that would apply to us, this is from King Henry VIII until now. Before the Pilgrims, before even the Council of Trent, until now. That is a lot of history to cover. And the biblical authors do it in the space of four books. Okay? And that makes, again, that makes sense. Imagine twice the amount of information that you have in American history covered in just a few biblical books. It makes sense that they're going to highlight some things and suppress some things. They're trying to get through this, right? And again, they're telling it from a certain point of view. One of the very interesting things, let me talk about 1st and 2nd Chronicles for just a second, is 1st and 2nd Chronicles more or less covers the same period of time as 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings. And boy, is that interesting. Because if we only had 1st and 2nd Chronicles, there'd be a whole lot of stuff that we had no clue of. Like, for example, that Solomon ever went bad. Because that doesn't fit the story that the chronicler is trying to tell. And the reason I mention this to you is because clearly we have at least two inspired authors who are even talking about the same events. And some mention things that others do not. Right? One mentions things that the other one doesn't. The other focuses on things the other one doesn't. Which should give us a sense that if we had more than one account of Joshua, or more than one account of Judges, or more than one account of other historical books in the Bible, that we'd be like, oh, there's a whole lot there that I didn't know about, because for whatever reason, the inspired author just neglected to say it. One of the famous ones is, and we'll get there in a bit, but let me just say it right now and make my point, is the king Omri, who gets like five verses in 1 Kings. He seems completely unimportant. He's born, he rules, he dies. We would have no idea that he had any relevance to history whatsoever unless we had extra-biblical sources who all talk about the empire that he founded in northern Israel, that he was the most powerful military king northern Israel ever knew, and that the rest of the nations didn't call Israel Israel, they called it the kingdom of Omri. Okay. So from an international perspective, he was enormously important. And in the mind of the inspired author, he just wasn't. Because that's not the point that the inspired author is trying to make about history. Like, what does it matter if he conquered parts of Syria? That has no relevance to how God deals with his people. Okay? So understand that. And I mentioned this last time. Ancient history, all ancient history, has different standards than contemporary history. And we would be doing the Bible a disservice if we expected the historians of the Bible to write like contemporary historians from Oxford rather than contemporary historians from ancient Greece, say. Okay, they wrote according to their time. Does everybody understand all that so far? Okay, good. Now, 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings are sometimes considered just two books, Samuel and Kings. Sometimes they're considered, and I'm talking about in ancient Bibles when they're inscribed. So sometimes they're just Samuel and Kings, no division. Sometimes they're considered as four books of the same series, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th Kingdoms. Some older Catholic Bibles have it like that. The contemporary division is based off of the Jewish names of the latest kind of Bible we have. But my point is that everyone kind of understood through history that these are a multi-volume set of one work, right? It is one story, one author, one narrative from 1 Samuel all the way through 2 Kings. Okay. And so we begin with the end of the period of the judges, which, as I mentioned, Pabal. Okay? Everyone did according to their own desire because there was no king in Israel. Right? It was not good. It was not good. And as part of that, we see the ark in Shiloh. So Shiloh was the first place that the ark kind of came to dwell, and it was kind of a proto-temple. And it was that. Eli and his sons were corrupt. Everyone was corrupt. There was corruption all the way through. And in the midst of this, we have Hannah, whose name in Greek would become Anna. I want to say in passing that the story of Samuel in the New Testament is deliberately read onto John the Baptist, so that John the Baptist looks like a second Samuel. But in what's known as the Proto-Evangelium of James, which is a early Christian work outside of the New Testament, but still very early, the whole story of Samuel is read onto Mary, so that Mary becomes the second Samuel. So it's very interesting there. Including her name, her mom's name. Hannah means Anna. Hannah and Anna are the same name. One is just the Hebrew form, the other is the Greek form. Okay. So, anyway, Hannah bears Samuel. Now, Samuel is an interesting character. It seems like he's a Levite. He's also a prophet. He's also a judge. He may have some priestly blood in him because several times he does offer sacrifices. It's not clear. What is clear is that Samuel is the last great figure before institution begins. Okay? So, we go from Joshua to Samuel, and God is just kind of ad hoc raising up these characters to lead Israel in the middle of crisis. You get to Samuel, he's really the last one. He's the greatest one. And there are many things about Samuel that imitate Moses, right? Samuel's a great saint. And, in fact, this is, again, a Deuteronomistic point. Because Moses said in Deuteronomy, a prophet like me will the Lord your God raise up. So for both Samuel and Elijah, I'm not going to go into the intricacies of this, but there are echoes of Moses' life in both Samuel and Elijah to show that Moses' prophecy was true, that a prophet like me, God would raise up. And the New Testament does this too by constantly pointing to Jesus as a prophet in the image of Moses. Right? He's more than that, but he's also that. And so, as you know, Samuel is dedicated to the Lord from an early age. You probably know these stories. These are some of the stories we read the most in Mass. And then, he's about 13, God calls him in a dream, and Samuel mistakes the voice of God for the voice of Eli. Eventually, here I am, Lord. I come to do your will, right? And he goes and he serves the Lord. And he begins to judge Israel. Now, Samuel does a number of things, but Israel, despite the fact of Samuel's greatness, doesn't really seem to acknowledge Samuel too much. And part of this is the destruction of Shiloh. So, while Samuel is judging Israel, suddenly he disappears from 1 Samuel. And the Israelites go to war against this new power, the Philistines. We'll talk more about them in a second. And they lose. And they're like, oh, bring up the ark, because we can't lose if the ark is with us. And so they get the Ark of the Covenant from Shiloh. And they lose even worse. It's like they lose terribly. It's like an utter destruction. And then the Philistines go and sack and destroy Shiloh too. And when the Ark is kidnapped before the Philistines get to Shiloh, Eli's sons, who were priests under him, who were cheating from the offerings, they were taking the offerings to themselves and offering God the refuse, they die. And then when Eli hears that the Ark was captured, he falls over backwards and breaks his neck, and he dies at the age of 98. So this is really a true culmination of the destruction of the status quo from Joshua to Samuel, right? Because the whole point of Joshua was bring the ark will win every battle. Now we bring the ark, we lose. And the whole kind of system that had been in place for two centuries is destroyed. Now, the Ark of God going into Philistine lands does not sit idle. It causes cancer and rats and makes the idol Dagon bow down and worship it, and then kills, I think, 50,700 Philistines in one go. So, basically, in the words we would have today, they accidentally kidnapped something that was radioactive, right? And it's really what happens. It is the essence of them having a radioactive thing in their midst and not knowing. And so finally they're like, take it back! But they go and hide it in a little town. And nobody really seems to know where it was. Remember, this is before social media or email. They didn't notify anybody. They just put it in a little town. It's not in Shiloh. Israel doesn't know where it is. They feel exiled from God. And in the midst of this is when Samuel's active. So Samuel comes back on the picture, and God is working through Samuel. And Samuel does his best to renew Israel. We're going to have to skip a lot because we're covering a lot tonight. Okay? Suffice that. But Samuel's sons, in fact, there's a deliberate connection here. Samuel's sons are corrupt. Just like Eli's sons were. In fact, there are deliberate connections between Eli's sons and Samuel's sons. So just when you think, finally, God has raised up the right kind of judge, the greatest of them, truly, it still don't matter. Because there's no one to succeed him. He's going to die. And then what are you going to be left with? Which was, of course, the whole problem of the book of Judges. Ad hoc charismatic rulers accomplish nothing long term. And the problem is that Israel is now facing a threat the likes of which they've never faced before. They're facing the Philistines. This is not the Midianites. This is not Ammon. This is not Moab. This is not the little petty kingdoms around them. The Philistines were a military power that was on a whole other level than anything Israel had faced. Technologically, on a whole other level. Because the Philistines had something that neither Israel nor their friends had. The Philistines had iron and knew how to work iron. And everybody else in Palestine was still with bronze. And I don't know if you know the difference, but if you hold up a bronze sword to an iron sword, the iron sword is going to go straight through the bronze one. Okay. Also, it seems the Philistines were the sea peoples that ransacked a number of other civilizations and killed them along the Mediterranean basin. And historically, this is a little bit of a stretch, but not much. As best we can tell, these are the grandchildren of the people that Homer wrote about in the Iliad and the Odyssey. So that Greek army, that Mycenaean army, that actually was able to summon up tens of thousands of soldiers to go waylay Troy, has fallen into a dark age, but has not forgotten their martial past, and so now they're all warriors, and they're just sailing around the Mediterranean Sea sacking things. So think not just Philistines, think Achilles and Odysseus' grandchildren, right? The great heroes of the ancient world are now going up against people who don't even have a federal government, have no way to raise an army, have no way to defend themselves, have no centralized anything. And that's why they go to Samuel and like, give us a king, like the rest of the nations have. And Samuel says, no, you're rejecting God, because that was the whole point of Judges. You don't have a king because your king is God. And remember, we talked about that last time, about how I think Judges is part of Israel learning that the idea that you have no human authority, that you have no human institution, that it's just about the people and God with nothing in between, fails. It fails again and again and again and again. It is a bad idea. But Samuel is the last real proponent of that. You're rejecting God. And God says to Samuel, really, I mean, remember, this is a great saint. God says, basically, it's a little bit more subtle than this. See, anyway, I think you're just mad that they're rejecting you. I'm okay with it. Give the people what they want. And so Samuel's pressured, and he finally agrees to give them a king, but then doesn't right away. And why does he not? It's not clear. Is he procrastinating? Is he still stewing? Or is he waiting for the right person? And then comes the wonderful event where a young man from the tribe of Benjamin loses his dad's donkeys. And he's going around Israel searching for the donkeys. And I guess really the whole story. And he can't find the donkeys, and then his servant says, hey, there's a prophet nearby that apparently all the rest of Israel knew, but this young man did not. Let's go ask him. Maybe he knows where the donkeys are. And they go, and when Samuel sees this young man, the Spirit of the Lord rushes upon him and says, this is the king of Israel. And his name was Saul. And Saul starts out as an incredible figure. Okay? Saul is filled with the Holy Spirit. Saul dances with the prophets. He looks, what we would call today, Saul seems to be speaking in tongues and having a charismatic revival. That's pretty much what's described in 1 Samuel. He is filled with the Holy Spirit in ecstasy. And then Saul becomes king. And he binds the people of Israel together in a very real and powerful way. They had never been bound together since the time, really, of Joshua. And now all 12 tribes are working in concert for the first time since then. So it's been about 200 years. Okay. And Saul begins to have, and this is really shocking to me, but he begins to have military victories against the Philistines. Now, one of the reasons he has military victories against the Philistines, God is with him, but also he's bright. The Philistine power, the real Philistine power, were their iron chariots. It was like tanks in the ancient world. Okay, and basically what Saul does is he lures them off the plain up into the mountainous regions, which is fairly close to the coast in Israel, so that their chariots can't function. And he ambushes them in guerrilla warfare, is really what happens. And he drives them back to the coast. He's not stupid enough to attack the coast, because on the coast, their chariots work just fine. But he contains them to that kind of strip, which in fact is today what? The Gaza Strip. Okay. He contains the Philistines to that Gaza Strip. And in fact, the cities in the Gaza Strip are exactly the same cities named of the Philistines in 1 Samuel. But he wins the highlands. And this is important. Okay. Now, Saul does two things that the scriptures say is why he lost the kingship. It's not clear at the time, and it's not clear if either of the two is more important than the other. But he does two things, and what we can say is that both of them are an overreaching of his authority. So one, he goes to war against a petty kingdom that God had put under the ban. Now, we talked about the ban last week. You're supposed to destroy everything. And I had mentioned that scripture scholars say one of the reasons maybe this was a reality, why God would ask this, is so that the Israelites would never ever get profit from holy war. So they would never think of holy war as a way to make money and use it as an excuse. Well, Saul kind of really violates the ban. He kills everything, but instead of offering the herds to the Lord, he uses it as a feast for his men who won, and he spares the life of the king and holds the king for ransom because he wants to make lots of money. Now, again, is Saul fully aware of the theology of the ban? Probably not. Is Saul just out to line his pocket? No, he's probably saying, I need to field this army, and it costs lots of money to continue to do so. So this is one of these ways where it's like, okay, Saul makes a big boo-boo, but this is not a Judas moment, okay? I want to be clear about that. the other big boo-boo that Saul makes, that God says, this is why I rejected you from the kingship, is he's going to battle one day, and there needs to be a sacrifice before the battle begins. And Samuel's supposed to offer the sacrifice. And unlike Father Sinsad, Samuel's late. Okay? And Saul is looking up and saying, we're losing our advantage. If we don't go now, we're going to lose initiative in the battle. So Saul says, well, I'm king of Israel, and he offers the sacrifice. Now, to understand how bad that is, imagine, hard as it is, that I was late for Mass, and Nicole said, well, Father Sinsad's not here, I'm going to say Mass. Exactly. Because that's what happened. Now again, there had never been a king in Israel. And in every other country, the king was also a priest. So was it clear in Saul's mind that he couldn't offer sacrifice? Probably not. But it also seems clear from the narrative that he kind of knew that he was at least pushing the line. Okay? And so, God rejects him. Now, because of this, while Saul is still on the throne, God tells Samuel, go anoint a new king of Israel. Well, that's a problem. You know? Like, Saul is still on the throne. Saul still has legitimacy. And Samuel goes and anoints the young man David. Right? Who's like 13 and says, hey, you're going to be king. What? And David's like, okay, we have a king. Right? And Samuel doesn't just anoint David as heir to the kingdom, which would be bad enough. Samuel anoints David as king. Like, no, you are now the real king in Israel. Okay, cool. Right? What am I going to do with the greatest war leader that Israel has ever known? I'm 13, and you're telling me to go be king. How's this going to work? Right? And so then we start to talk about David and this tension between David and Saul. So David shows up, as you know, when Saul's at battle with the Philistines, and this is the story of David and Goliath. Very famous story, but not famous for the reason why the Bible makes it famous, right? For why it's important in the Bible. In the Bible, it's a sign that, like, here's a new leader of Israel. He's revealed in front of everyone. Saul tried to give him his armor, and for a number of reasons, David said no to Saul's armor. He comes back, and the people of Israel sing, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. So the people of Israel notice that here is a new charismatic leader anointed by the Lord. But the problem is that we're no longer in the time of judges. And Saul has every right to say, like, no, we're past that. I'm the legal king of Israel. I am on a throne. I have an heir. You asked for a king. Here I am. We don't go around just picking the newest, latest, fattest guy to be our leader. And so there's a lot of tension there. And Saul begins to fall. It's one of the saddest stories, really, in the Scriptures. And what happens to Saul is difficult to explain because ancient authors didn't have our categories. It looks like something of a mix between sin, mental illness, and demonic oppression. And let me just say in passing that while I am very clear that those are three separate things, I think we act like those are three isolated things and they're not. If a demon is oppressing you, you will probably also have mental illness. Okay. In the same way, as if you're like really sick in your body, that doesn't mean that your mind is going to just be perfectly healthy, right? These things are not isolated and disconnected from one another. And so Saul, who loves David as another son, and Jonathan, who loves David above the love of women, whatever that means. It seems that they were just really close to each other in terms of deep male friendship, not weirdness. Saul decides to kill David and goes back and forth on this. When it says, when the dark spirit would come on Saul, Saul would want to kill David. What would the dark spirit be? Is this a demonic spirit? Seems so. Is this like just frustration and depression? Seems so. Is this something like bipolar disorder? It also seems like that too, from what we see in Saul's life. And it really is sad. So it would say that the dark spirit would come on Saul and David would play for Saul. And Saul tries different things to trap David, to kill David. One of the things that he does to David is David trying to figure out in his head, what does it mean that I'm going to be king while Saul is still here king, and I acknowledge that Saul is the legitimate king. As David says, I'm going to marry Saul's daughter, and then maybe, you know, it would make sense that I'd be Saul's heir. And Saul doesn't like this because David's just a little shepherd boy. He's the 10th son of his father. He's not in line for any inheritance. So I forget exactly the number, but it's something like, you can have my daughter if you bring me back the foreskins of 100,000 Philistines. Which, in other words, that's a suicide mission for anybody but David, who comes back with the least savory gift of all time and just drops the sack of them in Saul's court. Okay? Because he did it. And of course, the irony there is the circumcision is the sign of the covenant. Philistines are famously uncircumcised. This is twisted in all kinds of ways. Okay. It's almost like David was making the Philistines part of the covenant. Of course, he wasn't. Saul finally just goes head on, wants to kill David. So David seemingly betrays Israel and goes and serves the Philistines as a commander, and becomes an army commander in the Philistine army. But what he would do, again, no YouTube back then, what he would do is he would go out with another division on a raid of Israel, turn on the other division, slaughter all the Philistines, then come back and talk about his great losses that he suffered in Israel. So he was undermining the Philistines while he was there. His men, who were all Jewish, who follow him, eventually say, look, you got to go back. I mean, Saul is driving Israel into the ground. He goes back. Saul pursues him. I think it's three times Saul is at David's mercy. David could have killed him. He's asleep. He's trapped, etc. And each time David spares him. It was very different from Saul always trying to kill David and just failing. In the midst of all this, Samuel dies. And now Saul is completely adrift. It really is a tragedy. Saul's story is a true tragedy. Completely adrift. He gets so adrift that even though he was a righteous Jewish man who had ended paganism in Israel and put to death all pagan priests, he hears that there's still a pagan witch in the town of Endor. And he goes to her by night, secretly, and says, I need you to summon the dead for me. And she's like, what? Like, do you not know that Saul will kill me for doing this? And he offers her money. And she raises the dead, and the spirit that she raises is Samuel. It's the only time in the Old Testament that we actually hear of, like, a ghost coming back. And as soon as Samuel raised, she freaks out because she realizes the guy in her hut is Saul. Right? And he's like, no, I'm not going to kill you. And Samuel's like, dude, what are you doing? Like, have you fallen so low that now you're practicing necromancy? What? Like, just accept that it's over, is basically what Samuel tells Saul. And stop bothering me. Which, I mean, is fantastic. Okay. And Saul just breaks down. And eventually Saul goes to war and Saul dies. But again, it's one of these things that, remembering that it's roughly the same time period, if you're going to talk about almost a Greek tragedy in the Old Testament, it's Saul. A man chosen by God, a man filled with every one of God's gifts, a man who united all of Israel, a man who won incredible victories, a man who did take his office too far, but certainly not as far as numerous of his ancestors or descendants would do, much less his ancestors. And yet he's the one that just is just crushed by everything that goes on. And so it's a hard story, it's a rough story. But then we move to David, who is now first king of Judah. This is important. David gets named king of Judah first, but not the other tribes. Saul has a remaining child, Ishbosheth, I think it's pronounced. And the tribes of Israel, the other 10 tribes, we have Judah and Benjamin in the south, the northern tribes unite under Saul's son. Wasn't in line of the kingdom, but everybody else was dead. And Saul's greatest general, Abner, is serving Ishbosheth. And then Abner does something terrible. Abner just betrays him. Like, takes his entire army, the whole army of the north, and just goes to David and said, we should really be serving you. And defects with the whole of Ishbosheth's army. At which point Ishbosheth is murdered and dies, and Saul's line is extinguished. Abner, however, I believe, if I remember right, is then killed by Joab, who is David's general, who is very problematic throughout 1 and 2 Samuel. So it's all a mess. And I want to be clear that it's all a mess. But after that, the tribes of Israel come 7 years after David declared king of Judah, and like, look, basically, we still need a king, and we've got nobody else. So they all swear allegiance to David. Shortly after this comes as a shock to many people, David leads a military campaign into the heart of Canaan against a power that had never yet been defeated. And we're in 2 Samuel chapter 5 here. Okay? He leads them against the Jebusites. The Jebusites had a city that was very strategically located and had never been conquered ever in 200 something years of Israelite domination of the highlands. Anybody know where that city was? Jerusalem. Jerusalem wasn't even conquered until after Saul was dead. And so we think of Jerusalem as the great kingdom capital of Israel, and it is, but it wasn't that until David. David is the one who captures Jerusalem. And it seems that somebody in the city betrayed the gates to let his men in. Because Jerusalem is well positioned. It's a difficult city to lay siege to. But here we begin to see the centralization that had long been promised. Once David takes Jerusalem, Israel begins to truly cohere as an actual kingdom, with a capital, with a bureaucracy, with a structure, and with power. Because David is still a great military leader. And he's able to box in the Philistines, he's able to cow every other small kingdom around them. Israel, for the first time, truly, since Joshua, and it depends on how you read Joshua, Israel is a military power that needs to fear really no one. And as part of this, David, in 2 Samuel chapter 7, of course, says, "It's a shame that I'm living in a palace of paneled wood." This is important to know. Wood is very precious in the Holy Land, especially in the southern part, because it's dry and trees don't grow. So wood was incredibly precious. That's why so many things in the Bible are made of wood. And we're like, so what? They're like, no, this was very precious to them. "Here I am living in a palace of paneled cedar," he says, "and the ark of God is in a tent." Now look, before we go here, God had never asked for the ark to be in anything but a tent. It's in the tabernacle. What is David doing? He's doing a number of things. But one of the things is that by thinking of a temple now in his new capital, he's taking the ark in a tent, which is by definition a transitory nomadic center of worship, and bringing it to the capital to have a centralized place of worship, which Exodus did not ask for, which Numbers did not ask for, which Leviticus did not ask for. What book of the Bible asks for one centralized place of worship? Deuteronomy. And that's why the Deuteronomistic historian makes such a big deal of this. Okay? Finally, we're going to have one place of worship. However, it's not given to David to do it. But before, I mean, David says, I'm going to build this temple. And his prophet Nathan says, sounds like a plan. And then that night, Nathan is asleep and the Lord appears to him in a vision and says, go tell David, no thank you. Are you going to build me a house? Instead, I'm going to build you a house. And this is very important. 2 Samuel chapter 7 is one of the most important chapters in the entire Bible. It is not well known. People don't just throw it around. But 2 Samuel chapter 7 is one of the most important chapters in the Bible. Because it's when God promises David that David's heir will always rule over Israel. The son of David will reign forever. This is the basis, the foundation for every Jewish hope for the Messiah. Messiah means anointed one, as David was anointed king. God made a promise. The son of David will live forever. The son of David will rule forever. Again, a reminder that this is written at the time of the Babylonian exile, when the king of Israel was deposed. The king of Judah was deposed. There is no son of David ruling. And so that becomes even more frustrating. Like, how do we square this promise, this covenant by God, with the reality that looking around, there's no king of David ruling us, right? And that's where the prophecies of the Messiah really take off as a future hero that God will bring to deliver Israel. Obviously, it's going to have huge impact on the New Testament when we get there, but it also has huge impact on the Old Testament. Okay. So David goes to war. One of the things that David does, of course, is commit adultery with Bathsheba. All right? I'm way behind time. This adultery with Bathsheba, a lot of people think that Bathsheba somehow seduced David. No. Okay. Bathsheba was bathing on her roof, which is where you go so that people can't see you. And David's house was just higher. And it says David was meant to be at war. It's the time when kings go to war, and David was just lazing around his palace, and he wakes up from a nap, it says, and he just goes out onto his roof. He's like, oh, look at that! I mean, he's being a peeping Tom. And then he sends his soldiers to collect Bathsheba. Right? This is much closer to an act of violation than it is an act of seduction on Bathsheba's part. Okay. However, first, they have a child that dies, and David repents. And then Bathsheba gives birth to Solomon. Now, David does a lot of other stuff, and there's the whole thing with Absalom. It's just a ton of stuff, but I need to jump all the way to the census. So at the end, David takes the census, at the end of 2 Samuel. This is a bad idea, and you should remind people of that whenever they come to your doors. God has forbidden this! Okay. And why did God forbid a census? He doesn't forbid a census in America. He forbids a census in Israel. Why does God forbid a census? Because there is only one real reason to do a census in the ancient world. It's to measure your military might, which means you're trusting in numbers, you're trusting in yourself, and you're not trusting in the Lord. This is one more way that a king is violating and overstepping his role. And God sends a plague. kills everybody. David goes up, sees the angel sheath his sword on a certain mountain where the Ark of the Covenant had been in the past. And this is going to be the mountain where the temple is built. Okay? That's why, it's one of the reasons why it's important. Now, let's jump to David dies. Solomon becomes king, not without opposition. There's a lot of struggle for Solomon to rise. Bathsheba, however, has taken her role as consort to the king very seriously, and she works with Nathan, the prophet, and really does some cool political scheming. Bathsheba becomes a great schemer, and always for the right reason. I mean, she's not like a evil mastermind. She's a woman who knows that this is the only power available to her, and she uses it well for good purpose throughout the scriptures. Solomon comes to power. Of course, you know the story that Solomon is a young child. God appears to him. I will give you anything you ask for. Solomon says, give me wisdom so that I can rule well. And God says, since you ask for wisdom, I'll give you everything else as well. And God does. Solomon's kingdom is by far the strongest Israel has ever been in history, period. Okay, I mean, they have more weapons now. But in terms of extent of land ruled and influence in the ancient world, Israel was a legitimate, almost superpower for a little while. And they had, Solomon ran a trade network that enabled him to trade as far away as India and throughout the Mediterranean, and all the money was coming to him. He also built the temple, and in order to build the temple, which we'll try to talk about a little bit more in 1st and 2nd Chronicles, taxed the heck out of the people of Israel. Crushing taxes. Okay? Crushing. And then forced them into corvée labor, which means once every 12 months, an entire tribe had to just lay aside their field and go do public works for Solomon's kingdom. And the people were okay with it, because he was Solomon, and he was bringing in money hand over fist, and the kingdom of Israel was flourishing, and God had chosen him, and he was the son of David. This was all working because he was popular. But boy howdy, can you tell, this is setting seeds for destruction in the future. One of the things that Solomon set seeds of destruction for is he had more than one wife. He had a few. If I remember right, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Okay. And the reason for this, for the wisest man in the world to have 700 wives and 300 concubines, is that's how you secured alliances in the ancient world. These were treaties. So he literally had 1,000 treaties with other powers around him. That's how you become a superpower. But then, you know, even the wisest man in the world can be driven crazy by 700 wives. I'm just saying, it just happens. Okay. And they're like begging. Why do we have to worship your God? Why do we have to worship your God? Why do we have to go to the temple? Why do we have to worship your God? And finally he goes insane. He's like, enough! And he builds pagan temples for all of them. And falls into idolatry. So the first 20 years he goes to building the temple. The second 20 years he goes to really centralizing his power, bringing in all these women. But once the temple is built, shocking, shocking, the taxes don't go down. And Solomon no longer looks like this great anointed leader who is inspired by God. Now he's worshiping at pagan temples, he's bringing in foreign women, and the people begin to grumble. And Solomon dies, and his son Rehoboam does not have any of the talents or gifts that Solomon did. None of them. Not least, he lacked charm, though at least he was smart enough not to say one thing. He actually increases the taxes. And people, of course, complain. Why? Is there a war? Is there a temple? Why? And he dismissed all of his father's counselors and only promoted his young men. And then his young men tell him something, which is truly one of the greatest stupid lines in all of history, which is euphemistically translated in every Bible. Okay, I'm going to tell you as closely as I can with children here what it actually says. When the people of Israel complained against Rehoboam, the young men told them to say, basically, no one cares what you think because my manhood is bigger than my father's thighs. Yeah. Luckily, he doesn't actually say that to the people of Israel. He says everything else they tell him to say except that one line. But it's exactly in that mindset, right? Like, clearly, we're in the mindset of a young, spoiled man with young, spoiled advisors who thinks that all of this is his right, not his duty. Right? I have the power, and I don't care what you think. Well, Israel cared. And Israel had not forgotten that 10 of its tribes only came to David after 7 years. And so the 10 northern tribes rebel and break away and name their own king in the north. And that king's name is Jeroboam. Okay, so this is all happening about 920 or so BC. Rehoboam and Jeroboam have this split kingdom. And this, if you're just listening to the Bible in church and you don't know where you are in history, this is why it can become very confusing. When the kingdom splits, it is now two separate kingdoms. Imagine the Civil War, except it was never reunited. It really is the South versus the North, and the South is poorer than the North, significantly poorer. The North is known as the Kingdom of Israel. The South is known as the Kingdom of Judah. And this is confusing because Israel and Judah mean other things at different points in history. But for about 400 years, Israel means the Northern Kingdom and Judah means the Southern Kingdom. Jeroboam goes and founds a couple of things. He learned from David. He's like, well, if I'm going to have a kingdom here, which, by the way, not seemingly approved by God. There's like no prophet or anything who anointed him. If I'm going to have a kingdom, as far as I remember, if I'm going to have a kingdom here, then I need to do what David did. I need to have a capital, and I need to have a place of worship. Because if my people are still going down to Jerusalem to worship, then I have a problem. Right? And so that's what he did. He built a capital at Samaria. And then he built two temples, one at Dan and one at Bethel. Now, in the past, Bethel was where Jacob had worshipped and had seen the angels of God ascending and descending. Dan, unfortunately, as you might recall from Judges, this is a place where that Levite was hired out and just started his own religion up there. Like, cool. Now, what does Jeroboam put in Bethel and Dan? We've already talked about this. He puts two golden calves. And he says, behold, Israel, your God. Which is why every biblical scholar in the world thinks that Exodus was edited post facto to say whatever they worshipped originally was changed to be a golden calf, and then Aaron uses the exact same words Jeroboam was. Because Jeroboam's not an idiot, right? Jeroboam's not going to use the one most famous example of idolatry in all of history and then try to start a new religion from it. It's infinitely more likely that somebody seeing Jeroboam do exactly this said, oh yeah, this happened in the past, so let's connect the two, right? It's even the case that Jeroboam's sons are named almost the same thing that Aaron's sons are named. Okay. So again, something happened in Exodus. But somehow, most scholars believe, I'm among them, it wasn't quite that close. Like an editor came to show the inner meaning with the same mess that happened with Moses and Aaron. Do you all understand that? Okay. So now we have the kingdom of Israel in the north. Israel in the north is where Galilee and the middle of Israel are today. Fabulously wealthy. It's where all the really arable land was, where you could grow stuff and have plantations. More importantly, most importantly, for history, I should draw this on the board, but I don't want to waste the time. You have a power up here. Assyria, Babylon, something. There's always a huge empire up here. And you always have Egypt down here. Egypt's been there forever, and Egypt's always rich. And the trade route between this power and Egypt ran right through Israel. So, kind of like Panama is really wealthy today because of the Panama Canal, Israel was really wealthy because the only trade between these two superpowers ran right through Israel. Because of that, the kings of Israel would always be stronger than the kings of Judah and also more corrupt. There is never a good king of Israel. There's not one king of Israel, with the exception of Jehu for like a few verses, that the Deuteronomistic historian approves of. However, you might think that with the Deuteronomistic historian's interest in the temple, interest in Deuteronomy, interest in Jerusalem, and interest in the Davidic line, that he would then just ignore the kingdom of Israel. He doesn't. And why doesn't he? Because God doesn't. And in fact, from 1 Kings 16 through 2 Kings 13, which is a good bit of this history, everything's focused in the northern kingdom. Why? Because a prophet like me will the Lord your God raise up. So, in 1 Kings 16, we start to have we have Omri comes to power. Omri's son is Ahab. Ahab is famously crooked. And then marries Jezebel, who makes him even more famously crooked. And then out of nowhere, in 1 Kings 17, Elijah just rises up. Sirach will later say, he just appears like fire. And says, all this is wrong! You're all wrong! You're all stupid! It's fantastic. He's like a commenter on a Facebook post. It is amazing. Okay. But unlike them, he actually has the courage of his convictions, and what he's fighting is Baal worship. So Elijah is going to go through a lot, and Elisha goes through more. I'm going to have to skip around here, but I really want to hit this idea of Baal worship. Because Israel had largely gone over to Baal worship. At least worshiping Baal along with Yahweh, in many cases worshiping Baal instead of Yahweh. And connected to Baal, the Ashtaroth. The Ashtaroth would have been, or Astartes would have been Baal's wife. Who is Baal? Baal's name, Baal just means the Lord in Canaanite. So it could be very simple, I think, for your average person in Israel to maybe have been worshiping Baal accidentally. Because the name just means the Lord. So, like in Syria, what do Catholics call God? Anybody know? Allah, because that's the Arabic word for God. And so it could make perfect sense that like somebody growing up in that who's not very theologically educated is like, well, what's the difference between Islam and Christianity? We both worship Allah. Right? That could easily have happened for a number of people in Israel. For those it didn't happen for, what was going on was money. Because, again, remember how we had said Israel is not yet monotheistic. They're henotheistic. They don't know that there's only one God. They just know that they're only supposed to worship one God. But their God, the God of the Israelites, has always revealed himself to be a God of battle. Well, Israel's not waging battle on anybody anymore. Israel wants money. And Baal, unlike Yahweh, doesn't rain down destructive hail from the sky. He rains down, you know, rain. And if you want to grow plantations in the Middle East or the Near East, what do you need? Rain. So they're like, well, we're going to pray to the rain god, and we're going to make a lot of money. So Baal is the god of rain and lightning. Okay? And Jezebel imports Baal worship, and Ahab promotes it, and the people fall over themselves to worship Baal. Okay. Now, Elijah, after Jezebel had killed numerous prophets of the Lord, hundreds of prophets of the Lord, Elijah is in hiding. He comes out, and this is really great. This happens, by the way, near Mount Carmel. He challenges the prophets of Baal to basically a god-off, right? We're going to have a duel between gods. And Elijah explicitly picks a test that Baal's prophets should win. We're going to put a sacrifice on some wood. Nobody's going to touch it. And whoever can call down fire from the sky, that's the real god. What is fire from the sky? We tend to think of a fireball. That's not what they're talking about. What is fire from the sky? Lightning. So the god of rain and lightning should win this battle. And the prophets of Baal are there, they're dancing, they're cutting themselves, all kinds of things. And Elijah is on the side trolling, and I love this. Call louder, he may be sleeping. Okay. He's a god, he may be distracted, maybe you should yell louder. He's trolling them the entire time. Okay? Nothing happens. Then Elijah's turn comes. And he goes and he gathers 12 basinfuls of water to just make it harder, and douses the wood to make it wet, right? But also probably as a sign of mockery of the god of rain, because Elijah had called down a drought for 3 years. We missed that, but he did, and it didn't rain. And then Elijah's like, "Lord," and the boom, right? Lightning strikes immediately and consumes the sacrifice. And then Elijah, in a religious, tolerant man that he is, calls on the people of Israel and they slaughter the 450 prophets of Baal. Now, why? Two reasons. One, Deuteronomistic history. Deuteronomy says if a prophet rises up and gives a false prophecy, that prophet should be put to death. So this is justice according to the law. But it's also justice according to the fact of Jezebel had slaughtered all the prophets of Israel, right, to import her fake religion. But then Jezebel is a little miffed, and I'm going to kill that man. And so Elijah flees, and he goes all the way down to Mount Sinai. Well, not first, he goes to a broom tree, and he pouts. And, you know, it's fair. He's exhausted, man. He's like, this is ridiculous. Like, they're hunting my life. I tried to do it. Like, I thought this was over. Right? I proved you as a real god. We slaughtered their prophets, and they're still in power. Why didn't this work? Basically. And he's incredibly depressed. And an angel appears to him and says, eat a pancake and go to sleep. Which is literally what happens. And Elijah goes to sleep. He's like, eat another pancake. Okay. And then he walked 40 days and 40 nights through the desert of Sinai to Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb. And he goes up and prays, and this is very famous, right? Exactly the opposite of Sinai. Everything that happened to Moses does not happen to, well, it does happen to Elijah, but God's not in it. The earthquake, the fire, the strong driving wind, everything that was the sign of God in Sinai is now not the sign of God for Elijah. And the reason for this, I think, even though it's on the same mountain, is to teach Elijah a lesson. Right? God is not always in the big displays, like the big show-off and like the big slaughter of the prophets. And he comes in the still small voice. In other words, the real work is going to have to be more subtle, more behind the scenes, more long-lasting. And then God gives Elijah three tasks to do. And God bless Elijah, he only does one of them. Okay. The only one that he does, the most important one, is he goes and he anoints Elisha as his successor. So that the prophetic mission would continue on. Now Elijah is taken up to heaven in fiery chariots. Elisha asks for a double portion of his spirit, which does not mean twice as much as Elijah had. It means two-thirds of his spirit. Because the eldest son, the heir, got one-third of the father's property. So when he asks for a double portion, he means not just one-third, but two-thirds. Because if I'm going to do your job, I at least need two-thirds of your gifts. And so Elisha says, not easy, but if you see me ascend to heaven, it'll happen. He does. Okay. And then Elisha goes and does a number of things himself, which are very powerful. And Elisha is not as well remembered as Elijah. He's not as great a prophet as Elijah. One very interesting thing, which I invoke sometimes, and we need to remember that this is probably some kind of folklore that kind of got its way into the Bible, and it's the message, not the event. Some young boys were calling Elisha Baldy, 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 and Elisha said, curse you, and then two she-bears ate them on the spot. Which, you know, the next time that you insult me, you better watch out for some she-bears, okay? But, look, there's no details given to this. It's just, like, dropped into the narrative. But if we're going to say, well, what's going on here? He was probably tonsured as a sign of his consecration, and they were mocking his prophetic office. And he's like, no, we've answered this already. This is not fake prophecy. This is not false prophecy. I am from the Lord, and those who stand in the way will face the Lord's wrath. One of the most interesting things that happens with Elisha is he happens after he dies for us Catholics. This is very incredible. He's dead. And somebody falls on his bones and is healed. So even though in the Old Testament, if you touch a dead body, you're supposed to be unclean, when you touch the bones of a prophet, you're made well. So it's a foreshadowing of our veneration of relics. Okay. So now, after Elisha, we come in to this long period of time, 800 to 587 BC. And I'm going to kind of just brush this, but it's important. Two events. Okay, despite the work of Elijah and Elisha, the northern kingdom just goes back to worshiping false gods. And finally, their pursuit of wealth causes a problem. This will also be the time of prophets we'll be talking about next time we meet. This is the time of Hosea, this is the time of Jonah, this is the time of Amos. Jonah was a real prophet. Jonah's book, probably not historical. But the prophet really did exist. Okay? And all of them, I mean, Jonah's talking about Assyria, but Hosea and Amos are all about societal injustice, worship of false gods. Like, you, even though 2 Kings kind of skims over it, you get from the prophets what's really going on. And because of this, I think it's Hosea himself who says it, you sowed the wind, you will reap the whirlwind. We have another phrase for that in modern English, but I'm not allowed to say it here in this church hall. The last part of it is, and find out. And the reality is, okay, the reality is that that's what happened. Israel found out. And this newly risen superpower of Assyria basically said, we're tired of you stealing our money just so we can trade, and you're on the path to us conquering Egypt, and you're like a fly, and we're going to swat you. You think you're big and strong, and we're going to swat you. And it was somewhat like a war between America and Guatemala, and Israel was annihilated. And I do mean annihilated. Assyria came in, exported the 10 tribes, and they disappear from history. There's no return from the Assyrian exile. Those 10 tribes are lost forever. They assimilated to where they were sent, and they disappear from history. Assyria then moved in other people. Assyria was smart about this. They would, when they would conquer a land, they would cross-pollinate populations, because if they're putting you on land that's not your own, you're less likely to rise up in rebellion against them. Then you're not fighting for your homeland. And they moved them in, and these people brought their own gods with them, but also worshipped Yahweh. This is the God of the land here, so we're going to worship Him too. And those people were gathered around what capital? Samaria. And so they get called what? The Samaritans. These are the Samaritans. That's who the Samaritans are. They are the pagan peoples that Assyria moved in to the old kingdom of Israel, who picked up Yahweh worship, but also still worship their false gods. They might have interbred with some Jewish people, but ethnically they were not Jewish. And so this is why people are so frustrated with Jesus when he gives the parable of the Good Samaritan or deals with a Samaritan woman. Like, these are unclean people. Or they're pagan. They're half pagan. How are you going to deal with that? Right? And so Jesus' dealings with the Samaritans is really the first indication that the gospel is meant for more than the chosen people of Israel. Okay? So, as Assyria comes down, Ahaz is king of Judah. And Isaiah says, don't worry, God's going to deliver you. Right? And Ahaz says, how do I know? Well, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son. And Ahaz says, cool. And he calls in the Assyrian diplomat and he says, we surrender. Okay? Like that, I mean, he does not even try. We surrender. Okay? Because if they wiped out Israel, Judah didn't stand a chance. They were much poorer, much less powerful. We surrender. And so Judah becomes the puppet kingdom of Assyria. They maintain their independence, become a puppet kingdom. Then God raises up Hezekiah. Now, Hezekiah is a good king in many ways. Hezekiah is a saintly king, and the Bible celebrates him. He went around purifying Judah and as much as Israel as he could get into, right? And eliminated pagan worship, brought people back to the pure worship of God, celebrated a major feast. Hezekiah is a good dude. But Hezekiah also got into a little power struggle problem. Babylon, who was rising at the time, but not powerful yet, Egypt and a few other countries come to Hezekiah and they're like, yo, we're not a fan of Assyria. Are you a fan of Assyria? And Hezekiah's like, of course I'm a fan of Assyria. I'm one of their loyal puppet kingdoms. No, I'm not a fan of Assyria. Right? And so then Hezekiah does something really stupid. He shows the Babylonians the treasury of the temple. And he shows them this to show I would be a good ally. But all the Babylonians see is, to-do list one day, right? And we'll come back to that. And this is a problem. So Hezekiah rebels against Assyria. And everybody rebels against Assyria. And Assyria goes squat. This just crushes the rebellion. Except for Judah. Assyria comes with Sennacherib, this incredible general. He comes with something like 300,000 soldiers. That's an enormous army today. And he lays siege to Jerusalem. And worse, he does it in the midst of the Jubilee year, seemingly on purpose. So according to the Jewish law, which Hezekiah was enforcing, you could not plant or reap in the Jubilee year, so they had no food stored up for a siege. And they're dying. And Isaiah and everybody's telling Hezekiah, like, it'll be okay. Hezekiah, okay. And Hezekiah holds firm. And Sennacherib had actually taught his people Hebrew. And they're calling out in Hebrew to the people of Jerusalem, your leaders don't love you. You need to overthrow them. And Hezekiah's like, I don't know how it's going to work. And then the angel of the Lord comes by night and slaughters 186,000 of Sennacherib's soldiers in one night. And as my scripture scholar in seminary said, in the angel's name was cholera. Okay, but the reality is that even if the angel did use a biological disease and cholera did hit armies, it didn't wipe out 186,000 in one night. It was regarded widely as miraculous. And it broke the power of Assyria, right? That is, you lose two-thirds of your army. So they retreated. And Jerusalem was safe, but it was still under Assyrian control. And then the next king is Manasseh. Manasseh really reverts everything that Hezekiah does, overthrows it all. And this becomes a real question. Like, okay, if even the kingship just keeps flip-flopping, right, from good kings to bad kings, what do we do? Then you come to Josiah, which we've already talked about in Josiah's reforms. And Josiah does a great thing, but then he's followed by bad kings. Now, in this time, we have gone... So the Assyrian exile was 721. The siege of Jerusalem was about 680 B.C. 597 B.C. Babylon has now conquered Assyria and taken over its lands. And they remembered all the pretty things that they saw. Like, oh, here's this kingdom with no army, but a temple that's clad in gold, that has thousands of tons of gold and silver within it, right, that David had saved up. Sounds like a plan. So they first conquer Judah, but not Jerusalem. And the people of Jerusalem do not repent, because they're like, we don't need to repent. God has shown us that every army that comes against Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. La, 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 la. And they're not living, it's not trust in God. It's like, we can't be beat. And God goes, and then in 587, Babylon sacks Jerusalem and destroys the temple, takes all the treasures, and the Ark of the Covenant disappears. Okay. This is the most critical event in Jewish history since the Exodus. There are no more, I mean, there are a few commoners, but all the leaders and prophets and everyone who lived in Judah, who lived in the promise, they're all gone now. The promised land, promised to Abraham, has been lost. The temple has been destroyed. The Davidic kingdom is over. There are no Davidic kings left, as far as we can tell. And the Ark of the Covenant, which had been the sign of God's presence since Sinai, is no more. This is the most critical, the most crippling event in the Jewish mindset. And it will have ramifications throughout the entire Bible. It is so important that Matthew, in giving the genealogy of Jesus, goes from David to the exile, 14 generations. Right? Like, that's it. Like, David, exile. Those are the two bookends of this period of history. So, we will be dealing with this a lot. From here on out, we're going to be going into the prophets when I come back from New Jersey. We're not done tonight, but just let me know. And the reason why we're stopping the historical books, we still have a few historical books to go, is because we want to address the prophets in their historical context. So we're going to be talking about prophets who are in this period here, and then after that, we're going to be talking about prophets during the Babylonian exile, and then we're going to talk about prophets after the Babylonian exile. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is 1 and 2 Chronicles, which are books of the Bible. They're important. They are different from the Deuteronomistic history, but they cover the same period of time. So 1 Chronicles in the first 9 chapters goes all the way back to Adam, up to David, but it just does it by genealogy. So kind of like the beginning of Matthew just gives the genealogy of Jesus. There's no narration, there's no events, there's nothing. It's just 9 chapters of genealogy, which can tell you why we don't read 1 Chronicles a lot at Mass. Okay. But then, even though, by the way, the genealogy of 1 Chronicles ends with the first generation of Jewish people back after the exile. So clearly Chronicles, 1 and 2 Chronicles, was written after the exile was over. Okay. But it's exactly that is why it has a totally different lens than the Deuteronomistic history. And they're not incompatible. But David, and I want to be clear about this, the genealogy, I forgot to say this, the genealogy from Adam is from Adam to David, and at every point emphasizes the Davidic line. It talks about Judah before talking about Reuben, for example, even though Reuben was older. At every point, it's showing from Adam, not just from Abraham, from Adam until now, David was who God intended. Why David? Well, First Chronicles does a whole lot of paving over any sin or disappointment that David did, except for the census. And the only reason it mentions the census is because of the whole point of why it thinks David exists. The temple. In fact, a goodly part of First Chronicles is David saving up a ridiculous amount of material for the temple. I'll let you go look it up. I think I calculated one time, it's like 100,000 tons of gold, 587,000 tons of silver. It's a lot, okay, of material. He's like, I'm saving that for my son, who would then go and tax the people of Israel to death. Anyway, but then Solomon comes about in 2 Chronicles, and again, there's no indication that Solomon ever does anything wrong in 2 Chronicles. Like, there might be a whisper here, but there's nothing like what you see of Solomon's fall in 2 Kings. Because Solomon exists for one reason. He builds the temple. And then in the last few chapters, the last second half of 2 Chronicles goes through the rest of it. So, fully, you have chapter 1 through 9 is about the genealogy leading up to David. The rest of 1 Chronicles is David preparing the temple. The first half of 2 Chronicles is Solomon building the temple. And then you have the relationship of Israel to the temple until the exile, which, of course, when the temple was destroyed. But then 2 Chronicles ends with Cyrus the Persian saying, go back to your land and flourish. And as we'll learn from Ezra and Nehemiah, he also said, here's some money, go back and rebuild the temple. So clearly, the whole point of 1 and 2 Chronicles and the way it tells the story is focused on, we're back from the exile now, we need to build the temple. And we'll see when we get there that many post-exilic prophets are all about that. Israel keeps on refusing to build the temple. Because it costs a lot of money. Like, when you come back from exile, are you going to build yourself a house? Or are you going to give all your money to the church so that we can build a new Gothic cathedral? I bet I know the answer. Okay. Doesn't matter how good your capital campaign is. Right? And so they kept putting it off, putting it off, putting it off. And yet the prophets and the chronicler keep on saying, this is the whole reason we exist. From Adam until the Davidic kingship, it was to build the temple. It was to build God's house on earth. Right? So this is a very different thing from Deuteronomy. I mean, they're not incompatible, but Deuteronomy is like, yeah, okay, we need a centralized place of worship. But God is in control of history. God is educating his people. God is showing them good ways and bad ways of government. God is showing them blessings and curses. And this is, explains all the ups and downs. You get to Chronicles, like, we exist for the temple. It's a very sacerdotal or priestly way of looking at history, right? Israel exists for the sake of worship. Worship is done at the temple. Therefore, from Adam until now, our purpose is to build the temple. And that's inspired history too. That's not to say that that's wrong. That is a legitimately inspired view of history from the Holy Spirit. It's not complete. It's not complete. That's why we have two separate histories in the canon of the Scriptures. But it's a legitimate point of view. Because seriously, why else does Israel exist? And seriously, what's the point of Israel? If not to worship God. I mean, the Deuteronomistic historian is like, oh, well, you know, it's to fight heresy, and it's to fight paganism, and it's to establish justice, and it's to establish this international connection, and it's to have this relationship with the great powers. And Chronicles more or less says, it's for worship. And so Chronicles, if anything, this is one part of Deuteronomy in the Chronicler, seems to take very seriously. This is the first and greatest commandment, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That's why you exist. Why is this? But also, in a sense, because of that, this is why I think we read 1 and 2 Chronicles less in the liturgy. because there is a kind of thematic, narrative richness to the Deuteronomistic history that's, for lack of a better term, easier to preach on. Like, there are more lessons. There are more diverse lessons in 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings than there are in 1st and 2nd Chronicles. 1st and 2nd Chronicles is beautiful, especially the account of Solomon's dedication of the temple. It's gorgeous. It goes on for chapters. Less capable of making it into bite-sized pieces for the liturgy that we can preach on. For example, Elijah and Elisha do not appear in 1st and 2nd Chronicles. If we didn't have the Deuteronomistic history, we'd have no idea they existed. Okay? It's a very focused history. It's an even shorter history, and it covers more time than the Deuteronomistic history. And it is divinely inspired. But again, I think it's easier to say the point in a Bible class like this than it is from the pulpit, dividing that up over many days of reading. So what do I recommend you read? I recommend that you read 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, and 1st and 2nd Chronicles. I mean, get over yourself and read it. Okay, what do I recommend you read? I think, based on what we see in the liturgy, I think definitely 2 Samuel chapter 7 is something you need to read and reread and have kind of in your head. Right? I think if you don't know it well, the Elijah and Elisha narrative up there from 1 Kings 16 to 2 Kings 13 is important to read. Like, of the whole history, you're going to get the most out of that, I think, in terms of reflection. And it's important to know these things. And it's not for nothing, that except for Samuel, the rest of it's all about kings, and then suddenly we just focus on prophets, and the kings almost take a step back. And it's not for nothing that Jesus says John is another Elijah, and that Moses and Elijah appear to Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. Elijah is a very important figure in the Old Testament. So to know that story and to know it well is important. And then I would read in 2 Chronicles, I don't have exact citations for you, I just know it's there, the account of Solomon's building and consecration of the temple. And the reason I say that is because if you don't read that, I can say till I'm blue in the face how important the temple is to the Jewish consciousness. If you've never read those inspired words that talk about the building of the temple and describe everything that's in it and talk about what the consecration of it was like, it won't resonate with you. Like, this is inspired words from the Holy Spirit of exactly how important the temple was. And that's why it'll help us to understand how important it is when Jesus says, my body is the temple, and when Paul says, your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, and when the church says, the church is the temple of God, right? None of those things really resonate or make sense if you don't know the original temple in the Old Testament and how important it was and how important the Holy Spirit revealed that it was. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. So I'm going to be gone next week. I'm going to be in New Jersey. But then when I come back, it's going to be pretty much, God willing, straight on through. There are no interruptions. Lent is always an interruption of everything. We're going to start pressing into the prophets. We're going to talk about the pre-exilic prophets next time we meet. There are a number of them. The most important ones are Amos, Hosea, and Isaiah. Isaiah is huge. 65 chapters long. You're not going to read Isaiah by the time we meet next. But you do have a chance to read Amos and Hosea. And a lot of people have never read Amos or Hosea. And even though their books are small, these are incredibly important prophets. So I would recommend, even before we meet next time, that you've read Amos and Hosea. Okay? Let's conclude, and then I do have a few minutes for questions if anybody wants to ask questions. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. Glory be to the Father.